us. I'm joined live by author and historian Gerald Horn. Gerald, the authorities have failed to control the protests for 5 days now. There are reports of deaths. How do you expect them to act now?
Well, I would say that either in the short term or the long term, the prognosis for Prime Minister Erdogan is not very good. His is a textbook example of what happens when you pursue contradictory policies. You usually do not end well. What I mean is that Turkey prides itself on being a secular state. That is the legacy of its founder, Kemal Atatürk, from the 1920s. Yet Mr. Erdogan has pursued these so-called soft Islamicist policies, most recently trying to put restraints on alcohol. Mr. Erdogan has pursued contradictory policies also in terms of his foreign policy. On the one hand, he started off with the admirable slogan, zero problems with neighbors. But now we see that Turkey intervened in a muscular fashion in Libya. It's doing so right now in Syria. And yet it has bad relations with Israel at the same time, which is Syria's primary antagonist. Mr. Erdogan has pursued authoritarian and rather contradictory policies. And I will say now that his time is soon will be up.
Well, you cite many reasons for this anger there in Turkey. The Turkish president has stated that the message of these protesters has been listened to. And that message, of course, consists of all those facets you've been talking to us about. But we're not hearing the same from Erdogan, aren't we? The prime minister, why not? And you're saying that if he doesn't listen, he is on the edge?
I would say so. I would think that Mr. Erdogan has a lengthy list of antagonists and enemies. First of all, keep in mind that his party is based on an unwieldy alliance between wealthy elites and poor peasants in particular, whereas he has alienated the working class, which is now on strike, and the middle class as well. Not only that, but he doesn't have very good relations with the European Union. You know that France has turned thumbs down on Turkey's admission into the European Union. He seems to have good relations with Washington, but keep in mind that in 2003, Turkey turned down an opportunity to assist the United States with regard to its ill-fated invasion of Iraq. He doesn't have a very good relations with Iran because of conflicts over Iraq, not least. He doesn't have very good relations with Iraq because he's basically tended to pander towards the Kurdish population in Iraq, which has alienated Baghdad. So the length of enemies and antagonists of Mr. Erdogan is quite lengthy and long.
But he has friendly relations with the U.S., and yet the U.S. are now criticizing him and the authorities for the way they're responding to this crisis.
Well, he seems to have very good relations with Washington. Keep in mind that he was in Washington a few weeks ago, basically trying to twist the arm of Mr. Obama to get Mr. Obama to intervene in a more overt manner in the conflict in Syria. Apparently, he was disappointed with the results. But keep in mind as well that the United States is also the home of a number of exiles, Turkish exiles, who have a bone to pick with Mr. Erdogan as well. It seems to me that if he had good relations with Washington, Washington would have expelled these exiles.
Let me quickly ask you, many analysts now compare Taksim in Istanbul with Tahrir Square in Cairo. Is the unrest in Turkey likely to escalate further and perhaps give way to a really powerful uprising, something that we saw there in Egypt?
I think so. I think what you need to watch is the response of the military. The military historically has been the guardian of secularism in Turkey. Yet Mr. Erdogan has cracked down heavily on the military in recent weeks, months, and years. It seems to me that this creates an opening for the military, a military in Turkey that, by the way, has shown a propensity and a proclivity for pulling off coups. So I think that Mr. Erdogan would be well advised to try to negotiate sooner rather than later.
Really interesting to hear your thoughts, Gerald. Thank you very much indeed. Gerald Hall, author and historian, live on RT. Thanks a lot.
And you have been listening to Dr. Gerald Horn live on RT, that is Russian television, and joining us on the line from somewhere in the third world is Dr. Gerald Horn. And Dr. Gerald Horn holds the Morris Chair of History at African American Studies, and his research has addressed many, many issues, and he's author of about 35 books. Am I correct in saying that? You're almost at 35, correct?
You're in the ballpark.
Close to it. Good. Great, great, great. And how are you doing today?
Hey, man. Fine. How about you?
my good friend Reuben Carter would say I'm perfect, believe it or not. I've been on 7 for a while, but I feel like $1 million today. Can you talk more about Turkey? I mean, that piece on RT. Let me ask you this first. What type of reaction are you getting from people around the globe for your RT pieces?
Well, what I find striking about RT, which I've been doing now for over a year or two now on a regular basis, is that I think that some people feel shocked and surprised that a person who appears to be a, quote, African-American, unquote, takes the political line that I do. And then that surprises me. But I think it's a reflection of the fact that at one time, as you know from my writings, we people of African descent in what is now the United States, we took very oppositional positions with regard to U.S. foreign policy. But then after the retreat of U.S. apartheid and Jim Crow and the granting of a certain kind of citizenship, part of the bargain was that we would stop focusing so much on making alliances with the antagonists of U.S. imperialism, and we'd concentrate on domestic questions. So as a result, people don't know that there are people of African descent in the United States who take positions unlike those of Barack Obama or Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice, etc. And I think that's understandable because I regret having to say that. I think that if you don't use a muscle, it atrophies, it withers, and the foreign policy muscle of we Africans in the United States has really atrophied and withered over the years. Take a country like Turkey, for example. Turkey is one of the most important countries on this small planet. Just one data point amongst many, Muhammad Ali, not the boxer, but the great Egyptian leader of the 19th century, who formed a dynasty that lasted until it was overthrown in the early 1950s by G.A. Nasser, was an Albanian. Albania, of course, being a country just east of Italy and west of Turkey. And, of course, Muhammad Ali was affiliated with the Ottoman Turks. The Ottoman Empire, centered in Turkey for hundreds of years up until the 1920s, was one of the major forces in the world. I mean, it was sweeping through Europe like a hot knife through butter. Part of the legacy is that a good deal of the Balkans, Serbia, Bosnia, Bulgaria, of course, even Greece, were once dominated by the Ottoman Turks. It was only in the late 17th century when the Ottoman Turks were defeated in Vienna, Austria, otherwise they might have marched on to France. And Al-Qaeda and many conservative religious radicals think that the turning point, as they see it, for the devolution, the decline of Islam, was when the Ottoman Turks basically were defeated during World War I. And the so-called caliphate in what used to be Constantinople and now is Istanbul, where the demonstrations are taking place, was basically liquidated, which led to the rise of Kemal Atatürk, the founder of the modern Turkish state. Of course, I alluded to Kemal Atatürk in my remarks on RT. And looking forward with regard to what's going to happen in Turkey, it's going to have enormous impact. First of all, I'll just reiterate and double down on what I said about Prime Minister Erdogan. I think that anybody who's done as much damage as he has with regard to Libya, with regard to Syria, really needs to pay the price. He needs to be driven from office. But you should keep in mind, as I indicated in those RT remarks, that he has a lot of enemies. I mean, the Israelis would like to see him gone. I've come to the conclusion that Washington would like to see him gone, which probably tends to suggest that he will be gone sooner rather than later. I say that because, recall in my RT remarks, I made reference to these exiles.
Right.
Turkish exiles who live in the United States. One is the leader of the so-called Gulen movement, which people should know about because it's one of the most powerful entities on this planet. It's a religious entity. It's affiliated with Sufi Islam as opposed to Sunni or Shia Islam. And Washington is really pushing the Gulen movement and pushing Sufi Islam, which they see as not being as militant, certainly not as militant as Shia Islam, and not as destructive from Washington's point of view as Sunni Islam.
Gerald, could I cut you for 1 second? I just wanted to make a point that, you know, when I was growing up and I started looking at Islam, you know, at one point we were so naive, I was so naive that I thought that, you know, Christianity was all split up until I found out about Islam. You didn't even mention the Ismailis. I mean, there's just as many different groups of Muslims than there are Christians, but I just wanted to throw that in there.
Well, the Gulen movement has had a bone to pick, as I put it, with Mr. Erdogan.
Mm-hmm.
And the Gulen movement, you should know, has taken advantage. You know, you have this charter school movement in the United States.
Yeah, right.
Where the religious conservative Christians have tried to use state funds to open schools. And, of course, once the Nation of Islam started opening schools, they started trying to back away. But still, the charter school movement, which many teachers' unions are opposed to, has really taken off. And the Gulen movement has opened a number of charter schools, particularly in Texas, particularly in New Jersey. Many black kids go to these schools. They have a media empire that's very influential in Turkey in particular. They have all sorts of charities throughout Africa. And their leader lives on a farm in eastern Pennsylvania.
Oh, no.
And I should also mention that the Gulen movement doesn't have very good relations with Moscow, because Moscow sees the Gulen movement as a CIA front. And I should also mention that the Turkish military, which I suggested would be prone to overthrow Mr. Erdogan, and keep in mind that Mr. Erdogan has arrested and indicted a number of military leaders, and the Turkish military, as I suggested in my remarks, is oftentimes seen as a guardian of secularism in Turkey, which is true, as opposed to Mr. Erdogan's so-called soft Islamicist policies, which have led to restraints on abortion, restraints to heterosexual couples kissing in public. There are now closed-circuit television cameras to monitor that sort of behavior. Well, it's interesting that the Gulen movement apparently has a number of its militants within the ranks of the security forces in Turkey as well. And I should also mention that the military, like the military in Egypt, on which, of course, the military in Egypt in many ways has taken its historical cues from the military in Turkey, but like the military in Egypt, the Turkish military is a formidable economic institution as well, with investments in all sorts of enterprises, and which Mr. Erdogan has tried to circumscribe. So in any case, it's going to be quite a battle going forward, but I think that what's going on in Turkey is going to have impact all over the world, particularly in Africa. Recall that when Somalia began to come back a couple of years ago from decades of turmoil and instability and no government, one of the signals in that regard was when Mr. Erdogan landed in Mogadishu with a plane full of Turkish businessmen. Matter of fact, that's been his sort of M.O., so to speak. I mean, he just did the same thing in North Africa and Morocco, for example, just before he landed in Istanbul within the last 24 to 48 hours. He did the same thing in Gabon, the major oil-producing nation in West Africa that's a neighbor of the Congos. And, you know, many people talk about the role of China in Africa, and, of course, we talked about the role of Japan and Brazil and India in Africa. But Turkey has been playing a major role in Africa, and part of the destiny of Africa in many ways is going to be bound up with what happens in Istanbul, which is nothing new because, as noted, Africa has been a center of Islam, and Turkey, in many ways, over the past 500 years, has been a capital of Islam.
Let me say this, but if you take a bus. I took a bus in Toronto I was away for about 8 months. Maybe a year ago, I got on a bus on Queen Street, and they have very nice buses in Toronto, and I looked up, and I see this big picture of Kobe Bryant, and he's advertising Air Turkey.
Yeah, he has a very close relationship with the Turks, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, Turkey is a major player. As a matter of, I mentioned the contestation with regard to whether Turkey would enter the European Union. And part of the turning thumbs down on Turkey entering the European Union, quite frankly, has been based on Islamophobia. I mean, Turkey is a major nation. It has about 80 million people, which means it would be as populous as Germany, now the most populous nation in the European Union. And as you know, the relations between Germany and Turkey have historically been strong. They were allied in World War I. Germany has a large Turkish minority, probably the largest minority in Germany itself. And so there's a fear that if Turkey enters the European Union, it'll tip the scales even further towards Berlin's domination. But Berlin's domination allied with Ankara, allied with Turkey, which is bothersome to France. And, of course, there's more than a scintilla of Islamophobia in France, given the fact that it has a large Islamic population, many of whom are of Algerian origin or West African, for example, Senegalese origin. So it's a very complicated scenario that's unfolding in Turkey as we speak, and many are playing double games, as I already noted, Washington's double game, where supposedly they're pro-Erdogan, but I think that they would like to see him go. But unlike some of our friends on the left who clamor for the fall of regimes without contemplating who's going to replace the regime, like they did with Libya in 2011. I mean, it's like leaving a job without having another job lined up. That's how our friends on the left, at least in the United States, think. U.S. imperialism doesn't think that way. They'd like to see Mr. Erdogan go if they feel that his replacement will be more pliable. And I think that they feel that somebody allied with the Gulen movement would be more pliable, because then that would serve as a launching pad for pushing that kind of Sufi Islam throughout the Islamic world.
Let me say this before we move on to Syria. A good friend of yours and mine, John Woodford, used to be the editor of Mohammed Speaks newspaper, and he pointed out to me one time that he had dinner with Mr. Mohammed, and his wife is, for all practical purposes, is European. And Mr. Mohammed, after they, talked and all of this sort of things, Mr. Mohammed asked John Woodford, where is his wife from? And he said, what is her heritage? And Woodford said, Albania. Elijah Muhammad says, good Muslim country, and the rest is history. John Woodford was the editor of Muhammad Speaks for quite a few years.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I'm going through what I consider to be one of the most bountiful archival collections in terms of African-American history. And that's the papers of the Associated Negro Press, which was headquartered in Chicago from around 1919 till it went out of business in the 1960s. It had correspondents all over the world, including Langston Hughes at one time, Zora Neale Hurston, and many more. But I was reading just last week about a petition that a precursor of the Nation of Islam had filed with the Turks. They were trying to, in 1930, set up a settlement of black Americans in Turkey. As noted, Turkey historically has been a capital of Islam. I also just read this book called Black Russian, which is interesting. It's about this brother who was born in Mississippi in 1872, but somehow winds up being a major entrepreneur in pre-Bolshevik Russia. But with the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, he's expropriated, like many capitalists were expropriated. What's interesting about the book is that the Russian exile, who teaches at Yale, who writes this book, he tries to say that the persecution of capitalists in Bolshevik Russia was worse than the persecution of black people in the Jim Crow South, which is quite a statement. But in any case, this guy who was a major entrepreneur, he ran clubs, etc., he winds up migrating to Constantinople or Istanbul, where for years he ran a major jazz club there. And just to make a long story short, he dies in the 1930s, but his descendants are still in Europe, and as a matter of fact, are major entrepreneurs in Paris as we speak. I should also mention that during the Italian invasion of Ethiopia in the 1930s, that a number of Turks allied with His Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie to fight off the Italians, which brings up the point that there's been a religious fault line through a good deal of Africa from the Cairo, from the Cape to Cairo. And the Turks, once again, played a major role in terms of the spread of Islam throughout Africa over the last 500 to 600 years. And with their economy growing, that is something that we all should pay attention to.
Let me say that we wanted to move to, this is what I wanted to say. Jack Johnson was in Russia, too. I think he used to hang out with Rasputin, I believe, but Syria.
Well, Jack Johnson comes up in this book, The Black Russian, which I would recommend, because the guy whose name escapes me right now, who ran the clubs that I was talking about, he and Jack Johnson were close comrades.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Jack Johnson's legendary figure. I could talk about Jack Johnson, but we wanted to move to Syria. Are you going to be on Freedom Now on KPFK today talking about Syria by any chance?
Supposedly, and Turkey too, for that matter. But I guess the news from Syria is that apparently the tide has turned. The tide has turned in favor of the regime in Damascus, and now you see the North Atlantic countries scrambling to get this Geneva Peace Conference off the ground, but as Lakhdar Brahimi, the UN negotiator, who's of Algerian descent, mentioned, with regard to Geneva, this peace conference, everybody seems to be on board except for the Syrians themselves. And certainly the regime has had some rather stunning victories in recent days, boosted, by Hezbollah. A very striking development took place in the past week, however. There was fighting that erupted in the Golan Heights that separates Syria from Israel. Israel now controls it, although it's Syrian territory. It's contested territory, in other words. And the rebels began to fight the regime there. And what happens is that the Israelis then assisted the rebels in terms of getting medical care, which unmasked and unveiled something that I had mentioned on RT months ago, which is that there was a strange alliance between these rebels who were connected with Al-Qaeda and the Saudis and the Qataris with the Israelis and the United States and NATO, a very strange alliance indeed. But what happened was that after the Israelis gave this rebel fighter sanctuary and brought him to one of their hospitals, they had to evacuate the hospital because apparently he had hand grenades in his pockets that he didn't want to relinquish. They thought he was going to blow up the whole hospital. And I think that vignette tends to illustrate the volatility and explosiveness of this strange marriage between an Al-Qaeda-backed rebel force and Israel. But I don't think the Israelis have taken leave of their senses. I think from their point of view, they know that sooner rather than later, they're going to be fighting Hezbollah and probably the Syrian regime as well, and that weakening Hezbollah in the Syrian regime makes sense to them, even though I think it's a very short-term strategy. And we all also know that if these rebels come to power, they're going to be spending so much time liquidating Christians and Alawites and Shias and all the rest that they won't have that much time to confront Israel. So I think it's a very cynical calculation on the Israelis' part, but in a bizarre sort of way, it does make a bit of sense.
I wanted to kind of divert something. If someone raised a question to me, I have historically, personally, supported the Palestinians, basically because I feel that the Palestinians have been given a raw deal. But this is a person that raised a question to me, is that what have the so-called Arabs, or the, I shouldn't say so-called Arabs, but the Palestinians, how have they supported our, when I say our, the struggle of African people around the world?
that's the sort of question I used to always run into when I was in Toronto. the Palestinians, as you know, they're a fellow oppressed people. They don't really have a state. They don't really have sovereignty. They're dispersed all over the world. But having said that, it's well known that they have very close relations historically with the Southern Africans. Their ambassador in Zimbabwe, when I was living there, was one of the most fervent supporters of the liberation movements in the region. I should say that what the Palestinians were able to do, even though they didn't have sovereignty, was that they did a much better job than I would say many of these Africans in North America in terms of lobbying on behalf of African liberation. I mean, these Africans in North America really should have a bit more humility, it seems to me. I mean, you know, I'm doing this book on Haiti now. And so, you know, the Haitians in the 19th century, they campaigned vigorously on behalf of enslaved Africans in the United States and in Canada. That's why so many Africans from Canada and the United States wound up moving to Haiti. But then, after slavery was abolished in the United States, you had people like Frederick Douglass, bless his soul. I have no bone to pick with Frederick Douglass, but he became an emissary on behalf of the United States when the United States was basically trying to take over the entire island of Hispaniola and nix both Dominican Republic and Haiti. And Frederick Douglass was down with that. And so was John Langston, the ancestor of Langston Hughes, for example, who was also a U.S. emissary in Haiti. You know, I'm reading this case now of this slave trader, French slave trader, Pelletier, who during the U.S. Civil War was trying to seize Haitians and then sell them to slavery in Dixie, which of course, you know, that was not unknown at that time. But then he brought this lawsuit against the Haitians, saying that they put him in jail and they harassed him after he was caught trying to capture their citizens and take them to Dixie. And, of course, Frederick Douglass and John Langston, they supported the United States position, which was to crack down on the Haitian. So, anyway, you know, before these people start asking those sorts of questions, I think they need a briefing on basic historical facts.
Okay, we only have about 4 minutes. Can you go over time, or do you want to do a run, a rush thing?
Well, I'll just mention one point, which I think is quite astonishing, and people might be able to follow up on YouTube. There was an amazing development in this past week. There was a meeting in Cairo of President Morsi and some of his closest comrades, and they were talking about this plan by the Ethiopians to build a dam on the Nile River, which the Egyptians are opposed to. And so President Morsi and his comrades, they thought they were meeting in private, but actually they were meeting on television. And so they were talking about how they needed to focus these rebel movements in Ethiopia, weaken the regime. It was quite extraordinary because that was the first thing they came up with, which was, you know, we need to support these rebel movements in Ethiopia to weaken the regime so they'll back off of the dam. And people should really think about that in terms of two states. When they have a dispute, one of the first things one state thinks of is sponsoring a rebel movement in the other state, which it has a disagreement with. I think that's quite remarkable. I hope that's on YouTube. I haven't looked it up, but it would be quite striking and intriguing to see it.
Now, I wanted to ask you, before you leave, we have 2 minutes, but the meeting between the president or the heads of states of the United States and China, I definitely want to hear your take on that.
Well, look,
meeting in California, by the way.
We're at a historic turning point because the President of the United States is coming to this meeting with a very weak hand. It seems like the United States is a weak regime, but since the Republican Party opposition treats Barack Obama as if he were Salvador Allende, it's clear that the United States ruling class is not united but not behind him. And so it's very difficult for him to make any sorts of agreements. You know, these recent leaks about U.S. Working with Google and Verizon and Apple, et cetera, to monitor people's Skype conversations and email, supposedly non-U.S. citizens, and then with regard to U.S. citizens, to keep track of who they're calling on the telephone and on all of that. Well, you know, that's, you know, Mr. Obama was planning to raise the question of so-called cyber espionage by the Chinese, and he was going to raise the questions about Chinese hackers hacking into U.S. corporate computers. But how is he going to raise that credibly given these recent revelations in the United States itself? And to me, these revelations were not accidental coming on the eve of the summit. I mean, somebody, you know, as we well know, there are many people in the United States. We were just talking about Erdogan having a domestic antagonist.
Yes.
Well, Mr. Obama also has domestic antagonists. And it would not surprise me, quite frankly, if they were to get rid of him sooner rather than later. I'm talking about Mr. Obama. Although, once again, we have to think about who would come next, because it's not like the left is going to get rid of him. It's the right is going to get rid of him, which means that the person who would replace him would not necessarily be progressive. It would probably take positions even to the right of Mr. Obama. And so these are very complicated politics that we're working through right now. And, you know, I'm beginning to think that perhaps just like you need a license to drive a car, perhaps you need a license to get involved in politics, because it's even more dangerous than driving an automobile.
Maybe they're going to replace him with a right-wing Latino or right-wing woman or right-wing Asian. I don't know. Maybe Bobby Jindal. Maybe he can be running the United States. He's got all the credentials for he's to the right of Obama, don't you think?
Absolutely, the governor of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, Marco Rubio, the Cuban American senator from Florida. But it's not going to be easy. But anyway, they got Obama tied up at knots. In any case, so anyway, he's coming to this China summit at a time when the China Daily says that within decades the Chinese economy will be twice as large as that of the United States. Robert Fogel, a Nobel laureate in economics, says that within decades the Chinese economy will be 10 times larger than the U.S. economy. And as I said, the United States has a very weak hand, and China has the strong hand. And President Xi Jinping, he's causing worry and fret in the North Atlantic countries. To quote The Economist, the British publication, in an interesting turn of phrase, they said about President Xi, is Xi is or is Xi ain't Mao's baby? That is to say that they feel that he's some sort of leftist, and that they can't do business with him. So it's going to be a very interesting summit that's unfolding in Southern California as we speak.
All right, so next week we will be on. Your good friend Ome Rahamtula might be talking to you next week, but if not, we will definitely be on the case.
Fantastic. Take care.
All right, thank you. And we have been speaking with Dr.
Your destination number.
Gerald Horn. And we're going to take a music break and come back.